Then the smile faded, and he compressed his lips in an expression of perplexity. Was it not surprising, then, that Hambo had so easily come upon this particular fetish? By his own account, he had returned to his hut and found it on the roof. Danka, his friend and fellow tribesman, had seen him find it. Tongman's strolling between the lines had brought him, it seemed accidentally, opposite to Danka now. He stopped and looked mildly down.
You see, Hambo find the fetish, that right?
That right,
Danka said. You see him climb up roof, look round, find the fetish?
That right, I see him. He say, Danka, look this. Someone try kill me.
I no ask you what he say. I certain he say many thing. You see him look the roof other time?
Other time?
You see him look the roof other time, or just that one time?
Danko was a loyal friend, but his wits were nowhere near equal to Tongman's, and he had been taken by surprise. He hesitated a moment, then uttered a short grunt of contempt for the question.
I no see him look other time. Why he look other time?
Why he look other time? That a very good question.
Tongman resumed his perambulation between the lines.
Danka no see Hambo look other time. Nobody see Hambo look other time. I go tell you why.
However, for a moment he hesitated, his confident expression wavered a little, and he passed his tongue quickly over his lips. Then, with a dramatic increase in volume, he said,
Hambo no look other time, cause he sabby well fetish no on the roof other time.
Hambo shouted a denial and rose to his feet, taking some steps between the files towards Tongman. The latter, his brief attack of nerves now quite overcome, demonstrated his sense of theatre by turning his back on his furious opponent, drawing himself up to his full height, and raising Delblanc's cane high in the air.
Who got the stick?
He demanded loudly. Nima's baby, disturbed by all the noise, set up a lusty bawling.
I tell you one time, Hambo,
Billy shouted over the hubbub.
Now I tell you again. Tongman got a stick. Shove your oar in one more time, palaver finish. He bought he go free.
Hambo's face expressed violent displeasure, but he was obliged to return to his place. After courteous thanks to the Beckman for his timely intervention, Tongman resumed his case. He had the audience now in the palm of his hand. They might think, he said, that if a man knows exactly when and where to look for a thing, he either has some special information about it, or he has put it there himself. But Hambo had made no claim to special information, except only the knowledge of the death threats and the business of the dust, both derived from Arifa. Perhaps Arifa could now throw some light on these extremely puzzling questions. Arifa had been pondering all this while, and had hit upon what she thought a good way of neutralizing the damning point that Tongman had just made. In her eagerness, she did not wait for questions, a serious error, as it turned out.
Hambo no look de roof at a time. Ha ha, dat easy, say why. He no sabi iboti bad mouth. I no tell him iboti bad mouth. I no tell him iboti pick up dust. I tell him after. When I tell him, then he look.
You no tell him?
Tongman raised his eyebrows.
We go see now. Day you see iboti, that de day you take kunti root wash in creek. 7-8 other women, same thing altogether. That the day, yes? And you no tell Hambo that day?
No, I no tell him.
Man try kill you, beautiful Hambo, you no tell?
Why that?
Arifa settled the wrap over her ample shoulders and lowered her lashes.
Afraid Iboti too much, she said.
There was laughter at this, especially from the women. Arifa was bigger than Iboti and noted for her termagant temper.
Poor little cuckoo, poor Moana, Tabakali called. I so sorry for you.
Under this provocation, Arifa forgot her role of fearful woman. Her eyes flashed and she clenched her fists.
"Fulani baggage, crow pick you eye," she said.
"Never mind them,"
Tongman said, giving her a look of sympathetic understanding.
"I sabi why you no tell Hambo. You not certain, dat why. Early morning light no very good. You see Iboti pick up something, but maybe peace string, maybe peace flint, maybe not Iboti. That right?"
Flustered by the laughter and misled by Tongman's sympathetic tone, Arifa was brought to agree that, in fact, Iboti had been some considerable distance away and that a man picking up dust would not easily be distinguished from a man picking up any small object. But she still swore it was Iboti and said she knew it was dust because of the careful way he had carried it. Tongman turned away from her to address the assembly at large. The evidence against Iboti was completely discredited already, as he felt sure they would agree. However, he proposed to call one witness who would demolish any shreds of credibility still remaining. There was something of a sensation at this, for Tongman had told nobody about this witness, for fear she might be intimidated. It was Kudi, who had been sitting silent among them all this while. She was a quiet, long-limbed, rather shy and self-effacing woman, with a kind expression of the eyes. Gently, amidst complete silence, Tongman drew out her story. She had seen Iboti on that particular morning. She knew it was the same day that Arifa had been referring to, because it was the day for the washing of the pulped kunti roots. She herself had gone down to the creek, though a little later. There had been several women already there, Arifa among them. This evidence as to the day carried complete conviction. Everyone knew that the washing of the pulp was planned in advance, and that it was collective work, involving repeated saturation and straining, the women helping one another with the heavy baskets.
"So now did day fix, you tell us where you see Iboti," Tongman said.
"See him nearby de graveyard."
"What time day?"
"Morning. Sun just come up."
"What he carry?"
"Carry chop knife and basket."
"And you comin' from graveyard, dat right? Come from Wilson and Tebow grave?"
"Dat right."
This, too, no one would have dreamed of doubting. It was common knowledge that Kudi visited the graveyard frequently in the early hours of the day, so as to sprinkle water on the graves of Wilson and Tebow and conciliate their spirits. These two men had died because of her in the early days of the settlement, one murdered for her sake, and the other put to death for the crime. An aura of evil fortune had hung over Kudi ever since. Nobody held her directly responsible, but a woman who brings death to two men can never be quite as others are. Kudi was regarded as an unlucky woman, and so, to some extent, guilty. However, on this occasion, for Iboti, she was lucky enough. Tongman had allowed an appreciable pause for the significance of her statements to come fully home to the people. Now he put his last, crucial question to her.
"What course Iboti lay? He lay for hut, he lay other way, for bush."
"Other way," Kudi said without hesitation. "Iboti lay for bush."
"Iboti lay for bush,"
Tongman repeated loudly.
"I thank you. That on. Now, Iboti, stand up, hoist up your head, you no afraid. Only one thing you say these good people, where you go with your basket and knife."
It was Iboti's moment. He raised his head and straightened his shoulders.
"I go cut cabbage in the amak," he said in his drawling, thick-tongued voice.
"Iboti, you good man," Tongman said. "I sorry you have this trouble."
He was standing still now between the rows. It was time for the plea of acquittal, and he was conscious of the need to tread carefully. The case was won. He knew it from the faces round him. His fee was sure, his reputation enhanced. But a wise man thinks of the future. The shanty was strong and likely to get stronger. They were warriors as well as traders, whereas he was a trader only. It was highly inadvisable to make enemies of them. He had caused offence already, but this had been unavoidable. Now he would do what he could to mend matters. He cleared his throat and began, addressing himself to Billy. There were still elements of mystery in the business. They must all feel that. But one thing was abundantly clear. Whoever had put the fetish on Hambo's roof, it had not been Eboti. There was no case against Eboti at all. A reefer had seen a man pick something up, but that man had not been Eboti because he was on his way to cut cabbage at the time, and he was only a mortal man and could not be in two places at once. However, Arifa's mistake was natural. It was early morning and the distance considerable. The identity of the man she had seen would perhaps never be known. Possibly, if he resembled Eboti, it was the ghost of one of Eboti's relatives come to pick up something he needed. The fact that Hambo had known exactly when and where to look for the fetish could be explained by some message that had come to him in a dream or vision which had now disappeared from his recollection. Such things were known to occur. He, Tongman, was very far from wishing to make accusations against anyone. It was enough for him that Eboti should be cleared. On this, Tongman rested his case and returned the stick. The matter was put to the vote by Billy, as custom required, though now it was the merest formality. The show of hands in favour of acquittal was so overwhelming that a count of those against was not deemed necessary. The shanty contingent stalked off in stony silence, not waiting for the formal verdict. Billy pronounced Eboti not guilty of witchcraft, and within a very few minutes the clearing, scene of so much excitement, was once again quite empty of people. Chapter 51. Relief at Eboti's acquittal overlaid at first all other feelings in Paris. Before long, however, uneasiness came seeping back. Something of that cold and half-incredulous dismay with which he had greeted Hambo's plea. Certainly the verdict had been a victory for truth. Tongman's advocacy, the fortunate fact of Coody's presence at the graveyard, the good sense of the people, these had combined to triumph. But tyranny could take many such blows and still prevail, and it was this terrible resilience and recuperative power that was most in Paris's mind in the hours that followed. For all Tongman's attempts to gloss things over in his summing up, it was evident that there had been a conspiracy, that Hambo, with the connivance of Arifa and the probable complicity of Danka and Kireku, had practised to incriminate an innocent man and make a slave of him. The more Paris considered the matter, the more convinced he became that Kireku was the key to it. He was cleverer and more able than the other two shanty, and more far-seeing, a natural leader. He had been careful not to seem directly involved in the case, and he had taken no direct part in the pleading, but Paris felt sure he must have known of the enterprise and given it his blessing in some measure. However, the extent to which he might have encouraged Hambo remained in doubt, and it was suddenly clear to Paris that this element of doubt could provide a basis for talk between them. It would be better to go immediately, if he were to go at all, while he was likely to find Kireko still at home. All the same, the sun was well down in the sky before he finally made up his mind. Kireku's hut was on the southern edge of the settlement, the side furthest from the lagoon. Like Tongman, he had built a second hut, alongside the first, for storing his trade goods. Libby emerged from this as Paris approached and called out, though whether in greeting or to notify his master was not clear. Amansa, Kireku's woman, whom he shared with no one, sat outside the hut, shelling acorns and milling them between two blocks of wood, smooth and polished from much use. She glanced up, but made no other acknowledgement of Paris's presence. Kireko appeared at the entrance, looked gravely at Paris for some moments without speaking, then motioned him to enter. He was naked to the waist, and his chest and shoulders gleamed with the acorn oil which it seemed he had just been putting on himself. The palm matting on the side of the hut facing west had been raised, and sunlight reached into the interior, where the corner poles cast long shadows. Paris found Barton inside, sitting on a mat in one corner with his back against a post. He lifted his narrow face and nodded as Paris entered, but said nothing. Kireku gestured towards the mats on the floor, waited for Paris to sit, then sat himself. His long, narrow eyes were bright and fathomless in the sunlight, and those parts of his body in the shade shone with blue-black glints at every smallest movement. "You're welcome," he said. "You drink something. You drink beer?" "Thank you." "Barton, go get the beer."
"Aye, aye,"
Barton said. And Paris, as if in some uneasy dream where one struggles against recognition, heard in these syllables the same irony, too faint for insolence, the same servile alacrity as in the days when Barton had been mate on the slave ship. The response, too, was the same. Kireku directed a look of intimate disdain and irritation at his minister.
"Look live, then," he said. "Stir your stumps."
The beer was good, cool, unclouded, and not too sour to the taste. They had drawn close to drink, following the sociable custom of the settlement, by which the beer, like the gruel sometimes made from the same grain, was taken with long-handled shell scoops from the same wooden bowl. Paris smacked his lips politely at the excellence of the beer, and commented on the beauty of the scoops. They had been made, he was told, by Sefadu. He answered Kireku's queries as to his health and well-being, and waited through the long, hospitable silences. Whatever displeasure Kireku might have felt at the way the palaver had gone, he showed nothing of it now. The face that regarded Paris was equable and handsome, with its broad nostrils and wide, full mouth. Thin diagonal scars of tribal incision showed faintly on his cheeks. The marks of thought were on Kireku's face. There were fine wrinkles at the corners of his eyes and slight vertical folds between the brows, but its general expression was confident and resolute. It was the face of a man in command of his passions and of the circumstances of his life. Now, either from indifference or contempt, he gave Paris the opening he needed.
"Well, so it looked like Iboti not the man," he said. "Not less he got wing," Paris said.
Kireku chuckled at this and tapped his temple with a long forefinger.
"Iboti got brain of the bird, no got the wing," he said. "He not clever, that is certain," Paris agreed. "But that not a reason make him humble porter."
Grasping the opportunity thus afforded, he began to speak of his fears for the future of the settlement, if it became accepted among them that a man's weakness or stupidity or simply his poverty was another reason for that man to be made the possession of another and forced to do that other's bidding. Some men had short memories, but Kireku's was longer, and he would remember his own sufferings as a slave. If Kireku, as a leading member of the community, would speak to his fellow tribesman, Hambo, and explain these things to him, it might be possible to stop this tendency now, before it took hold among them and became customary practice. Kireku was a man of sense and experience, and he would know that once a thing became customary, it soon came to be regarded as lawful, and was then extremely difficult to root out. Concerned above all to find words that would express his meaning clearly, and show at the same time his confidence in Kireku as an ally, Paris had not looked very closely at the other in the course of speaking. When he did so now, he saw at once that his words had failed of their effect. Kireku's position had not changed. He sat cross-legged, his strong, well-shaped hands resting lightly on his knees, but his face had assumed the same expression of frowning severity it had worn during the palaver when he had intervened to protest at Paris's lapse from pigeon.
"What man you think me, Paris? What man you think yourself?" he said, after an angry silence. "You come here my house for ask favour. Man born me, I favour that man, no matter what, but you no born me. You buck a white man, come off slave ship."
Paris took care to keep his eyes steadily on the other. Any shift of gaze would be taken as weakness.
"White man, black man, all free man, all brother. Live together this place, all same boat," he said. "Same boat?"
For a moment Kireku seemed to waver between anger and amusement. Then his face settled into a fierce smile of derision.
"That the slave boat you talking about?"
He glanced round at his minion, who was seated to one side and slightly behind him. Barton, responsive as always to the need for background effects, sniggered loudly.
"Hear him laugh! He he!" Kireku said. "Barton, he sabi when to laugh!"
With a sudden gesture, he brought his right hand across his body and pointed to the livid scar on his chest.
"Barton, do this!" he said. "Barton,
put hot iron, burn me. How can he do that? I tell you, it cause Barton strong pass me that time. Now, Barton, my man, fetch this, carry that. He no do it, I kick him ass. Dat the same boat? You, big man doctor, look me eye, mouth ball, make me dance. People laugh, he. Now you come sweet mouth, ask favor me. Say we friends, side by side, no more slave. Dat the same boat?
He got you by the bollocks.
Barton was grinning. He seemed no whit abashed or put out by the slighting references to himself.
"He got a headpiece on him like I never..." "Barton, stow your gab,"
Kireku said. "All that finished now," Paris said, after a brief pause to gather himself. "That in the past. 12 year lived together, this place.
We no tink come here. Come here by wind and sea. Come here by God hand. You like say so. We just happen here, Kireku, but give us the chance, put ting all together right again."
He paused again, casting about for words that might somehow clinch the matter, failing to find them. Kireku's face had returned to seriousness, the look of derision quite gone. The sun was close to setting. Shadows inside the hut had lost form, seemed merely now a vanguard of darkness. Paris saw Amansa pass outside with an armful of kindling. There was a smell of wood smoke, and he could hear the voices of children, happy, angry, in the distance. It was a world, and precious to him.
"Give us second time here," he said heavily. "Give us second chance." "Maybe give you second chance, not me," Kireku said, and his deep-throated voice now held a quality of conscious forbearance.
Sarcastic or sympathetic, Paris could not tell which.
"I know Panya people from house, put slave mark on them, take for sell. You de one do that. You think one mind belong all us here, dat mind same you mind. Why you think I belong, you idea right wrong? I tell you why, Parry. It cause you think you clever pass me. You think your idea right wrong strong pass my idea."
His voice had quickened and stumbled as he spoke, and his hands had clenched. He made a brief pause, staring before him. When he spoke again, it was more deliberately.
"Dat, you big trouble. You never change. You always try make other people belong your idea. Like you play game with them. Move here, move there, like a mati game. You sabi? You try make people here this place do like you want. So you feel good, make man free, then parry feel good. Oh ho, no feel bad no more, make man free, windy game. But Kireku not peace a mati game, pick up. Put down. I no stay in place you want. I strong pass you. You a fool. You think this special place, but it altogether same other place. Iboti, Kali, Libi, these men slave. You no change that never. Go look for Iboti now. Where you find him? Find him Tongman field, working for Tongman. I build hut. Need man guard that hut. Build boat. Need boatman. Do trade. Need porter for cargo. Need them all the time, not just when they want. That the way ting go this world. Parry, where you been? This do real world. You know sabi that?"
"Thurzo was another who talked about the real world," Paris said after a moment, and as if to himself. He looked at Kireku and attempted a smile. "Funny ting," he said. "They talk about real world. They never mean real world where man help other man or spend him life do good for people. They allus mean real world like rat in the cellar or dung heap cock try get on top."
Kireku said nothing to this, and it was clear from his face that he thought it not worth answering. Paris too sat silent for some time. It was not so much the force and penetration of the other's argument that daunted him, considerable as these were, but the certainty and finality of the tone. He sought for a memory of Kireku aboard the slave ship, as if some clue to their present impasse could be found there, but no such memory was available in his mind. That shuffling, clanking dance to the sound of Sullivan's fiddle, The mass of listless limbs and faces in the shadow of the awning amidships, the terrible cries from the fetid darkness of the hold, the stench of defecation, the corpses, one so like another, somewhere among those herded, brutalized people, featureless, indistinguishable in misery from the rest, this drive to power still dormant, undeclared. Perhaps it could only have declared itself here, he thought, with a painful sense of paradox. His mind staggered suddenly at the thought of what manifold talents, what capacities for good and ill had been thrown from the deck of the Liverpool Merchant to feed the sharks. The moral argument, he now saw, had been a mistake. They were both trapped in the same bog. Perhaps all that was left was the argument of expediency. He thought of Del Blanc and his doctrine of necessity. Even freedom and equality might be seen as necessities of survival. "My life, in this place, just like your life," he said in low tones. "Some man weak, some man not clever. I say mind with you about that. But suppose I use weak man, make me strong pass other people, and you do same thing, then we go fight. This place altogether finish." But he knew as he spoke that he had failed, that the discussion was over. "You wrong," Kireko smiled, a genial smile of complete equanimity. He now wore the same air as when Paris had first arrived, unruffled, sure of himself and his world. "Barton," he said, "I called. Go get my jacket."
"Aye, aye."
Kireko nodded humorously at Paris. "Barton no slave," he said. "Barton too close me. He too bad man for slave.
Poor Paris. You no sabi nothing. No sabi de shit of de fire from de burning of de fire. I no ask come here. Now I hear, I fight for place. Strong man get rich. Him slave get rich. Strong man make everybody rich. Everybody dis place happy and rich come from trade. Some man not free. Never mind. Bugger it. Trade free. Dis palaver finish now. Barton, take Paris, show him way along."
It was a dismissal. Kireko looked austerely away while Paris rose and barely acknowledged his departure. As instructed, Barton walked some way with him. The former mate seemed disposed to say something on his own account, and they stood together for a few minutes some way beyond Amansa's cooking fire. The last of the sunshine lay over the settlement, and there was no breath of wind. Smoke from the fires rose in slow plumes, and the cabbage palms outside the stockade stood motionless and stiff, the dead, withered lower fronds, bright rust colour, where the sun caught them. Barton's face still bore some traces of the amusement which the recent conversation seemed to have afforded him.
"Kireko's in the right of it," he said. "He hasn't had the benefits of a liberal education, but he got the better of you. Stands to reason. You will not stop men of talent from rising up any more than you can stop caddies like a boatie from sinking. You will never stop human beings trying to improve themselves. That is the way we go forward."
"Improve themselves?" Paris was tired and discouraged and disinclined for further talk, but a kind of curiosity kept his attention directed to the other man now. The years had leached colour from Barton's eyes and dishevelled his brows and put grey into his wiry, ragged beard. But the peering, relishing expression was the same as ever, the shape of felicitous syllables forming on the thin mouth. These things would be the same until the day he breathed his last. "You think it an improvement when we prosper at the expense of others, and reduce them, and take away their dignity?" Paris had a sense, half resigned, half despairing, that the terms he was using were in the wrong language. "It is a very selective notion of improvement."
"You're a regular sticker, you are."
Barton spat delicately aside to express his disgust.
"You got no sense of the future. If it was left to you, the march of human betterment would be slowed down to a crawl. We would be in the doldrums without breeze enough to give steerage way.
There had risen to his face the old look of pleasure at the rich resources of language.
"We have got to reach out for something," he said virtuously. "Take a baby now. What is the first thing you will see a baby do? He sees something before his eyes. He reaches for it. He don't know what it is. Might be a lump of shit. Might be a diamond. He's got to learn for himself. When we stops reaching out, we are done for."
"Last time you reached out, you came near to losing your scalp," Paris said, with a degree of unkindness unusual in him. "You only saved it, I seem to remember, by keeping pretty low to the ground." Barton spat again.
"Times a man has to keep his head down," he said. "Any fool knows that."
There was a truculence in his manner which seemed new to Paris. It indicated, better perhaps than anything else could have done, the divisions that were growing among the people now.
"Times change," he went on after a moment. "This place is changing. There is pickings now, such as never before. The land between us and the St. John is almost empty. These local Indians are poxed out and dying. We know there is peace now with the French and Spanish. The seas will be safer. We can trade skins to Cuba. The English have took Florida for King George. There is an English governor in place now in St. Augustine. We shall have justice and fair play. No more of these blackguard dons lining their pockets and grinding down a people. I will tell you something now. I am a man that sees ahead. There will be a place up there for a man like me. I am a serviceable fella. Do you think I'm going to rot down here the rest of my natural life? Why do you think I answer to that black devil now?"
His face had grown envenomed as he spoke, and his voice had risen. It was clear that Kireku's contemptuous treatment was resented more than Barton dared openly show, resented enough to take the guard off his tongue now. Or perhaps, Paris thought, it was this he had wanted to say all along, the rhetoric about human aspiration, merely a preamble. Barton was devious enough, and probably by this time more than a little mad. Asserting a readiness to betray Kireku might seem to him like proof of integrity.
"I do not know why," Paris said. "I use him to serve my turn," Barton said in a rapid and confidential tone. "I wasn't Thurzo's fool, and I ain't Kireku's neither. I am waiting my time."
He raised a finger and laid it along his thin nose.
"I keep my nose to the wind," he said. "I am a man that sees ahead, I tell you."
Paris was silent for a short while. He was aware, as always with Barton, of a mystery. You could not call such a man wicked, even. He seemed to have his being below distinctions of good and evil, in some sunless Eden of his own. "You see ahead, Barton, God help us," he said. "But what a man sees must still depend on what he looks for. While I have got eyes of my own, I shall not need to borrow yours." With this he turned away and left the other standing there. He made his way back to his own hut, and remained there for some time in total silence and immobility. Then he thought of the clearing in the pine hummock where he had sometimes gone when his spirit was heavy. He would go there and sit for a while, and let the accustomed descent of evening bring its peace. He took the track that led in the direction of the lagoon. On reaching the edge of the pine ridge, he glanced back. From where he was standing, most of the settlement was invisible, cut off from sight by the trees. He could see the pale gleam of sunshine on the thatched roofs of the nearer hut. The stockade gates were open. Just beyond them, on the level ground before the first of the trees, children were playing together. They were full in the sunlight. He could see the rapid play of their shadows as they moved. No voices came to him at first, and he could not determine the nature of the game. There was a line of small children, somehow linked together, perhaps tied. Two larger boys, armed with sticks, appeared to be guarding them. A group of older children stood in a cluster some yards off. Kenka was among these. There was a quality of eagerness in his son's slight figure, recognizable to Paris even at this distance. A moment later he picked out the form of Tekka, tallest of the group. There was one standing slightly apart. It was the mulatto boy, Fonga, whom he knew well, having treated him regularly for an inveterate condition of congested sinuses. Fonga was a delicate, rather gangling boy, a year younger than Kenka, not well coordinated in his movements, something of a butt for the others. One of the guards, Paris now realized, was not a boy at all, though as tall as most of the boys there. It looked like Lamina, whose life he had saved when she was a baby. As he stood there, the wish rose in him to know the nature of the game they were playing. It came as a reprieve from his unhappiness, and then there was something potently suggestive in the way they had grouped themselves, something of ceremony or accustomed ritual about it, in this last lingering sunlight of the day. He saw Fonga point at the line of small children. The guards raised their sticks and made whipping motions at the captives. It was a game of slavery. Then Kenka stepped forward, a lonely figure between the group he had left and the linked line of slaves. Paris saw the raised hand, the uplifted face. The echo of the shout came to him. It was the first sound he was conscious of hearing. He understood now what the game was, and he was swept by the poignancy of his son's loneliness there, immobile, his arms stiffly raised between opposed factions. Paris knew that the loneliness was his too, and had never changed, the same now as at the moment of his intervention on the deck of the slave ship. It was Fonga who played Thurso, and this too was only to be expected, he thought. Power had its ironies of reversal. The weaker had been coerced or cajoled into performing the detested role of the strong. Entirely appropriate, too, that it should be Kenka, with his eagerness to shine and to excel, who had secured the empty role of glory, over in seconds, leaving him with nothing more to do. With close attention he watched the game to its conclusion, saw Thurso draw his pistol, saw Kavanagh make the gesture of throwing the heavy spike which had destroyed the captain's right eye and sent him staggering back against the bulkhead. Then came the wild shot that brought down Tapley with a shattered leg, performed now with much impressive writhing by a boy he did not recognize. Tapley's wound had turned gangrenous, and he had died 5 days later. Tekka the cynic it was who struck the decisive blow. As Rimmer, he stepped forward while the cursing Thurso fumbled to reload and stabbed the captain to the heart. A great advantage of the stage, that actions of irrevocable violence could be endlessly repeated, modified, Paris thought, as he resumed his way. Some profounder sense of the difference lay in his mind, though he could not immediately express it to himself. The sunlit arena, the quick shadows of the children. It was the orderliness of the performance, mysterious in its effect, that marked it off from the confused reality. This, to the touch of his memory, was glutinous with blood, thick with discordant sound, grotesque, Tapley's groans mingling with the imprecations of Thurso, as the blood was to mingle on the deck, Kavanagh shouting at the wounded captain about a drowned monkey, the late appearance on the scene of Del Blanc, still in his nightshirt. Of course, Jimmy must have related the events in precise order. Jimmy was a good teacher. He was one of those who had stumbled on a vocation here. He was gifted alike at pointing a moral or adorning a tale, and this was history now. Heroic protest, concerted rebellion, execution of the tyrant, a new social order. It ran like a clear stream, useless to require it to resemble the viscous substance of truth. Chapter 52. With nightfall, people began to congregate outside Nima's hut. Mats had been spread, and there was a good fire. Nima sat at the entrance, the baby in her lap, greeting the visitors as they arrived with their gifts and good wishes. She had been busy with preparations since the closing of the palaver that morning, sweeping out the hut and the space all around, cooking, tending the fire, pausing only to give milk to the baby. At the approach of the dark, she had stopped and gone to dress herself in her best, then taken up her position here. The results of all this labour lay spread on a litter of sea-grape leaves. Callie's eyes glistened at the sight, and the lean Sullivan invoked the saints. There were pieces of boiled fish, kebabs of venison on cane spits, a sweet dough made from acorn meal and dried cocoa plum. Various neighbours had made contributions. Tabakali, a friend and near neighbour, had made kunti cakes for the occasion. The day before, Danka, most accomplished of hunters, who had a friendship with Tiamoko in spite of conflicting trade interests, had brought a big turkey which he had stalked and shot on the edges of the cypress swamp. The unpredictable and taciturn Hughes surprised everyone by presenting a wild honeycomb and then leaving almost immediately. Children of various ages moved among the guests, round-eyed with excitement at so many voices, the leaping of the fire, the display of food. Tiamoko and Kavanagh, both a little drunk by this time, gave out the beer. It was Nima's first boy, and they had used up their entire stock of wild grain to brew enough beer for the party. By the time Paris arrived, things were in full swing. Fortified with beer, Sullivan had already given the company a couple of reels on his fiddle. He had now been joined by Safadu with a cane flute, limited in range but piercing in sound, and by Danka with a finger drum made of deerskin stretched over a hollowed-out section of black gum tree. These three had performed at similar gatherings before, and varied in their effects from a loud and cheerful dissonance to occasional wild harmony. Paris went up to Nima and laid his gift on the ground before her, beside the others. He had not much skill in making things, but during the summer he had discovered a variety of sapodilla tree, and had collected a number of the seeds with a view to planting them in the spring. They were like flattened beans in appearance, and glossy black. He had strung some of them on plaited palm fibre to make an unusual and distinctly handsome neckband. "This for you boy when he little old past now," he said. "I wish he live long time for you." He looked down at the baby, which returned his gaze with singular intensity. Its eyelids were polished and shiny, as if by some gently frictive agency of the air. They were tiny, the narrowest of rims for eyes so amazingly lustrous that they seemed to take up all the face. The hands were the only other visible part. Paris had seen a good many babies in his time, but the perfection of the hands moved him always. In the light of the fire he could see the paler webs at the base of the fingers and the tiny pink cracks of the knuckles as the baby gripped the edge of its blanket with the oddly fussy, faintly spasmodic clutch that marks the very young. "What name you give him?" Only now could this be asked. It was never divulged until the evening of the naming, for fear of the ill fortune that could so easily come from premature and presumptuous mention of a name. "Him name Kavamoko," Nima smiled. She was happy. She knew she made a good appearance in her shell necklace and blue cotton wrap. The baby had been much admired, and the party was going well. She nodded in the direction of her two men. "Dey two give him half-piece one name, half-piece other," she said indulgently. Her eyes were as bright as the baby's, and Paris saw the reflection of the firelight move in them. Some touch of awe came to his mind. The seated woman, prepared and composed, the simple thatch behind her, the gifts before her on the swept earth, the regard of the baby that seemed full of some precious knowledge. "I wish he lived long and happy for you," he said.
"Dis de first man, Pekin," she said. "Dey too give de name."
"It is a very good name," Paris said. As he spoke, the music ceased, and Kavanagh stepped forward, holding his battered pewter tankard, once the possession of the dead gunner, Johnson. Tiamoka, meanwhile, was making sure that everyone had enough beer to drink the impending toast. In the troubled preoccupation of earlier, Paris had forgotten a cardinal point of etiquette, which was to bring one's own drinking vessel on occasions of this kind. Now there was found for him one of the pumpkin calabashes held in reserve for the forgetful, and for people like Callie, whose personal possessions did not extend even thus far.
"De boy name Kavamoko,"
Kavanagh said, when silence among the guests had been achieved.
"Dat de name we give him, dat de name he keep."
This had been said very seriously. It was the official naming. Now Kavanagh paused, as if in search of some flourish of rhetoric. His face for the moment was sombre, dark red in the firelight. Suddenly he broke into a broad smile and raised his tankard.
"We drink him health, and happy, and good long life," he said.
All the people present echoed this and drank. The orchestra struck up again with renewed vigour. Paris glanced round. As always, he looked first for Tabakali in order to know that she was there, and well. She was standing with Salian and Dinka, tall and very beautiful to Paris, with her smile and the proud movements of her head. He saw some of the parties to that morning's dispute mingling together without apparent animosity. Hambo and Deboti and Billy were standing together in the same group. Kireku had at least deigned to make an appearance, though he kept apart, Barton, as usual, at his elbow. Paris drank and felt the sourish beer spread a warmth within him. His mood lightened. He found hope in this enclave of firelight and mingling voices and din of music, a hope that was inveterate, perhaps ultimately beyond defeat, tenacious enough in any case to acknowledge that only the surrounding darkness conferred unity upon them. An accident then, perhaps, but they had met here together to celebrate the appearance of a new life, and that surely was also to affirm a future in which new life could grow without stunting. Heated with his efforts, Sullivan laid down his fiddle and went to replenish his can. This brought him up close to Billy Blair, who was about the same business. Billy was in the best of moods, but he had drunk enough to make him slightly abrasive, and Sullivan, to whom he was very attached, always roused his spirit of satire.
"What, fiddle?" he said. "'It's a funny thing, but you haven't changed one iota, Michael. Still scraping away, just as you was doing in that whorehouse in Liverpool, the neat you and me come alongside all them years ago."
Sullivan detected at once the note of disrespect for his music, but he was not much put out by it. He was in a particularly exuberant frame of mind this evening, due in part to the beer, but mainly to the encouraging glances he had been getting from Coody, whom he had always thought a fine woman, despite the aura of misfortune that hung about her. She was young, too, not so many years older than Dinka. He had been playing with particular feeling tonight for her sake, and he felt that she had understood this and would not be averse to a man like himself appearing on the doorstep.
"Aye, be jabbers," he said. "You're right, Billy. And to think of it, I would never have come here at all if it hadn't been for you walking in that night full of boasting and vainglory. You haven't changed neither, Billy, all these years in the wilderness, and still full of yourself."
"Lucky for you, bonny lad, that I came in that neat," Billy said. "You was on a downhill path. I saved you from yourself." "Oh, aye, very lucky," Sullivan said with deep sarcasm. "I might have been living in a grand house by now, with silver buckles to me shoes, and lace to me cuffs, and drinking brandy from a crystal glass, instead of beer from a ship's canakin." "You would have been dead a drink or clap or both by this time," Billy said. "You didn't look set on a prosperous career when I sighted you hove short in that poxy tavern."
"The trouble with you, Billy," Sullivan said, "and it is the same trouble as affected you in them days. I remember making a mental note of it at the time. You're not a truly travelled man, in the best sense of the word. You're not acquainted with the usages of society. If you was, you would know, without needing to be told, that all doors are open to the artist."
He caught Coody's eye and smiled at her and raised his canakin.
"Never mind, shipmate, you cannot help it," he said. "I drink your health in spite of shortcomings."
Billy returned the health and drank, but the blood had come with a rush to his head at this condescension. Like practically everyone else, he had heard by now of Sullivan's failed attempt on Dinka. He had thought to say nothing of it, as taking advantage of a man who was down, but the other's unabashed and unrepentant air destroyed his resolution in a moment.
"All doors open to the artist, are they?" he said. "They wasn't open to you last night, was they? Doors nor legs."
"You have lost me, Billy. What legs is that?"
They had turned back now towards the fire, and Sullivan was making to where he had left his fiddle.
"Dinker's door wasn't open to you, by what I hear. While you was exercising your elbow outside, Safadu was exercising somewhat else indoors."
Sullivan opened his eyes wide.
"What?" he said. "You'd never believe I was trying to intrude myself. Is that what they're saying? Holy Mary, I was giving the young couple a love song."
Suddenly he noticed the majestic bulk of Sallion close by, and realized she could hear them.
"You got the story all foul up," he said, raising his voice a little. "I give the couple love song, give them music, make the first night sweet for them. I music man this place. You no think man can give something, ask nothing back? I real sorry for you, Billy. Look what Sallion do for you. She ask nothing back. That one good woman. All these years she cook for you and in Chebby. She never shut you out."
Billy, too, had now realized the proximity of Sallion.
"That truth," he said hastily. "She good woman, pass anyone. In Chebby and me, we sabby dat good."
"You sabby dat good?"
Sallion broke in, her broad, good-humoured face as severe as it could ever possibly be.
"You sabby dat so good, maybe you sabby dat dare no nyam in de house for eat tomorrow, except dry corn and kunti, no meat, no fish. You drink plenty beer, talk plenty fine. In Chebby, altogether, same. You think I feed two man six pickin, kunti mush, and squirrel tail?"
This public complaint stung Billy's pride.
Why, you say this now, middle de bloody neat. That just like a woman. She wait de time man happy, drink some beer, then she say, home, home, go find yam in de dark.
Fish in de creek, they no die when dark come, Tabakali said, joining in on Salian's behalf. The slighting reference to women had not pleased her. Faced with this formidable combination, Billy glanced round for Inchebi, but he was too far away to be of any help. He drew himself up.
Right then, he said. Me and Inchebi, we go out catch fish, soon de party finish.
Head full of beer, you catch nothing, Salian said scornfully. Catch fall on your face.
She smiled in spite of herself, and her body shook a little. Billy often made her laugh, though he rarely knew precisely why. It was one of the things that had kept her tenderly disposed towards him over the years.
"Catch packer, bite you ball," she said, still laughing.
She did not believe that he would go.
But Billy was on his dignity now. "You go see," he said. "Billy Blair, him word, him bond. Say do one thing, he do that thing. In Shebby altogether same-same."
He moved away in good order, turning short on Sullivan when he was out of range.
"See what you done? Now I got to go out fishing in the middle of the bloody night."
Sullivan appeared unmoved. "Ah, what we do for the ladies," he said. "But then where would we be without 'em, Billy? Tell me that. There is one here tonight that sees me worth."
"She needs glasses, then," said the exasperated Billy. "Michael, I make you out to be around 44 years old. You've got precious little to offer. A rabbit now and then, a few rows of pompions and pumpkins, a basket of clams. You'll never get a young un now. Not with all these lads coming up."
Sullivan smiled and shook his head.
"You're forgetting one thing, Billy."
"Aye, and what may that be?"
"You're forgetting the power of music."
The sound of the music carried far through the night. Occasional strains came to the ears of Erasmus Kemp as he advanced cautiously in the faint moonlight, with Nipke and the Creek scouts leading the way and the labouring troops strung out behind. Guessing that some sort of celebration was in progress, and thankful for it as reducing the vigilance of those he was seeking, he asked Cochrane to order a halt. It was his idea to encircle the settlement while everyone was sleeping and attack in the early morning before they had time to make any resistance. Surprise was the essence of this plan. They must be taken before they could scatter and run. Once in the bush, they would be impossible to capture. He had no resources for pursuit, and the troops would be vulnerable in the extreme to ambush and harassment. Everything, then, depended on this dawn attack. If successful, there need be little bloodshed. The whole population could be disarmed and bound and brought to where the boats had been left. With luck, they could all be at sea again by the evening of next day, on the way to St. Augustine. So Erasmus reviewed his plans, while the troops crouched waiting, straggled over a low outcrop of limestone, which was the driest land they could find. They were newly arrived from England, mainly country boys from Wiltshire, weary and dispirited now after long hours of struggling through this unfamiliar and difficult terrain, alternately scrambling and wading, burdened with musket and pack, dragging the high-wheeled cannon behind them. It had not occurred to their superiors that the hot, close-fitting, conspicuous tunics might be in any way unsuitable for an expedition of this kind. They had had to be disembarked the night before under cover of darkness, and had spent the whole of the following day lying concealed, waiting for nightfall. Two men were already disabled, one bitten by a cotton-mouth snake, the other with a broken collarbone from falling down a pothole in the limestone ridge. None of this affected the issue, and so it was not of much concern to Erasmus. He was close to his quarry now. It was not weariness he found himself having to contend with, but a tearing impatience. For a good hour after the music had ceased, he governed himself to remain there, on this rocky strand, with the misty exhalations of the marsh rising all around, weirdly shot with moonlight, vicious with mosquitoes, echoing occasionally with loud percussive sounds, like metal striking stone, produced, so Nipke had told him, by the jaws of infant alligators snapping at frogs and crayfish in the shallow water. When he was sure that all was silent ahead of him, he informed Lieutenant Cochrane that he was ready to proceed. By the time this order was given, Billy and Inchebi had set off in an opposite direction on their fishing expedition. They were not on very good terms to begin with. Inchebi felt, not without reason, that his consent had been taken too much for granted, and Billy's appeals to their joint honour were received coldly. But Inchebi was not a man to bear a grudge, and he had grown fond of Billy, despite the fact that they argued frequently together. Indeed, with Billy's constantly baffled sense of logic, argument was impossible to avoid. Quite apart from this, when two men are engaged in a task requiring such a degree of cooperation as does spearing fish at night, they had better put aside any difference between them. Once afloat in their shallow canoe between the low banks of the creek, the two forgot everything but the business of catching fish. They had made a hearth in the middle of the craft, raised nearly to the level of the gunwales, and on this they built a fire of lighter wood, the dried-out, resinous heartwood of the pine. This, split into small slivers, would blaze up and burn from end to end like a candle. It fell to Billy, as the less accomplished harpoonist, to tend to the fire and keep it flaming, also to help control the motions of the canoe as required. For this, a very fine, almost instinctive judgment was needed, and Billy was expert at it, even when slightly clouded by drink. Inchebi stood at the stern with his cane spear. He had fashioned this himself, pointing it with fishbone, carving the barbs and hardening them with fire. He used the butt-end to guide the canoe very gently, so as to steal upon the fish without any noise or disturbance of the water. For a man as dexterous as Inchebi, who had been given his first throwing spear at the age of 10 by his father as a circumcision present, fishing at night had distinct advantages. The dazzled fish would lie still for long periods, gazing at the flame, and the river bottom was revealed more closely to the fisherman than was possible in daylight. Nonetheless, it was generally a slow business, and slower tonight than usual, perhaps, since Inchebi too felt the effects of the beer. A shadow, a wrong movement, the faintest marring of the surface, and the fish would vanish in flickers of silver. Often enough, the thrust would fail, and then they were obliged to wait, drifting on the slow current, till all was calm, and the fish drew near again. It was a long time before the first successful strike, but then two more came quickly. Snapperfish, like the first, they had found a shoal. Lanced through, the red fish twitched briefly on the skewer, yielding in this death display the marvellous iridescence of its colours, pink and deep gold, burnished in the light of the flames. Billy, while not ceasing to concentrate on the fire and the stealthy management of his short paddle, fell slowly into a state of contemplation, induced by the silence around them and the gentle progress of the canoe. The flames before his face shut out the tree-lined verges of the river. Beyond their fire, the night was limitless, without boundaries. Within its range, all was a play of light and shadow. The surface of the water on either side was clearly illuminated, and he could see the fish lying tranced with light, a condition not much different from his own. "Except that I am safe. I am the hunter," Billy thought. He was a man impulsive to the point of rashness, and ignorant in many ways, but he had felt the need lately to understand the meaning of his life. He was convinced there was a meaning, if only he could find the key, and because of this he was always open to wonder, which is where, if anywhere, any such understanding must begin. It was wonder he felt now as he leaned forward to feed the fire with splinters and looked up at Inchebi standing poised beyond the flames, the reddish light cast upward on the wet shaft of his spear and the upper part of his chest, with its livid scar. Somewhere, amidst all this, the meaning lay, if only he could find words to state it. He had a sense that the sky was beginning to lighten. They would be returning soon. They would have fish to take back, perhaps half a dozen good-sized snappers. In the self-congratulation of this thought, the sense of being on the brink of some momentous discovery faded. But Billy knew at that moment that he was happy, and that he would not change places with an earl or a duke. However, in returning, Inchebi suffered an accident which, though slight enough, set the two men arguing. While drawing the canoe up the bankside in the first light of day, he slipped and fell against the hull, grazing his knuckles rather badly. He swore at this in a language unknown to Billy. Then he declared, with bad-tempered glances at the bush all around, that his accident, without a shadow of doubt, had been due to kudala, witchcraft. Billy stopped short on the path.
"You on that tack again? I real sorry for you, Chibi. Everything kudala, eh? We no find fish, you say kudala. We find fish, you cut your hand, you say kudala. So no sabi such a thing accident this world? Man cut him hand, that accident just happen. Nobody want it."
He saw the usual dignified, slightly somnolent expression of dissent come to Inchebi's face.
"You allus puttin' on ears," he said, with the beginnings of exasperation. "That you big fool.